Good morning. It is 8:35 and we'll call this meeting of House Fisheries to order. Present are Representative Johansson, Representative Edgman, myself, Representative Seaton, Representative Wilson, and Holmes are on their way soon. We can go ahead and start without a quorum on this overview, and we'll also have an overview on Fisherman's Fund following that, and then we'll take up the House Bill 26 as the last item. So let me welcome you. I would like to say that it's great to have you in town, and Ocean Beauty has saw some of your excellent products last night, and would you go ahead and fill the committee in, as well as the other folks around, as what's happening with Alaska Seafood and what you're doing helping us in the marketplace of products.
Certainly.
And go ahead and introduce yourself first for the record. So, okay. And then since you're both men talking there, if you switch, would you say your name each time, because the recording secretary, when you switch back and forth between people, doesn't always get who the voice is. So.
Good morning, Chairman Seaton and members of the committee. My name is Mark Palmer. I'm the president of Ocean Beauty Seafoods. Today, we're going to give a brief presentation on the overview of Ocean Beauty's production and marketing activities, largely related around salmon in the state of Alaska. Tom, introduce himself.
Mr. Chairman and the committee, my name is Tom Sunderland. I'm the director of marketing for Ocean Beauty Seafoods, and I'll be discussing new products and product development and how those needs are connected with what we do here.
Great.
Mark Palmer. Ocean Beauty has 7 shore-based processing facilities located around across the state of Alaska, really from Petersburg in southeast through central and Kodiak Island all the way out to Bristol Bay. Over the last 5 years, a big focus of Ocean Beauty's has been to modernize those shore-based facilities. The value-added salmon tax credit, Senate Bill, I think it's 162, has been in existence for 4 years now, and it was really a catalyst for starting more value-added processing here in the state. Ocean Beauty's utilized that tax credit every year since it's been in existence. Last year, we added another $2 million worth of value-added capacity to our southeast facilities and our Kodiak facilities. Those additions have added jobs. Last year we added 60 new processing jobs as a directly related to those value-added processing, and we had about $900,000 in additional payroll, and we purchased about 3 million more pounds of salmon that largely would have probably not been purchased, either because it was late season fish and the quality wouldn't have lent itself to go into the can, or it was off-grade fish that we were able to keep off the market and turn it into something that was a higher market value. Today, as we go through this, we kind of wanted to break it up into a couple of components. We thought we would talk about initiatives that affect the quality of the fish. So we're going to kind of start with it coming out of the boat, go through the kinds of things that we're trying to accomplish in our facilities related to marketing, and take it to transportation and some of the initiatives we have with our customers.
Great, Mark. And just let me interrupt for a moment and let the record reflect that Representative Ledoux has joined us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
One of the initiatives that was in place several years ago, the state offered low-interest loans to fishermen for the purposes of adding RSW to their vessels. I believe that money was exhausted in something like 2 days, that the amount of response that was generated from the fleet, and it was only available at the time to in-state permit holders. It was not, did not include out-of-state permit holders. We saw on Kodiak Island a lot of our fleet, our same fleet, take advantage of that to put RSW on their boats. We recognize that if the opportunity is there, the fishermen were enthusiastic about trying to modernize their fleet. We would encourage the state to support any program that offered the initiative to the, offered those incentives to the fleet to take the initiative to modernize their boats. There's still a lot of vessels around the state that don't have the ability to chill their catch after harvest and to delivery to our facilities. And we would also encourage the state to make that available to all permit holders. We market Alaska salmon. We don't market Alaska salmon caught by any certain group, even whether it's seine or troll or otherwise. It reflects on the state and our industry, and we think that any initiative that would support all the fishermen is a good one and one that would be embraced. This summer, we are going to start a pilot program out of our Bristol Bay facility that will focus on lead, ice, better handled sockeye out of that region of the state. And it doesn't take long to figure out one of the most limiting factors you have in that part of the state is the availability of ice. And Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation has an ice barge that there's lots of competition for. There's lots of interest. It's going to be fully utilized. We would also ask that the state consider ice barges for other parts and more remote fisheries where we don't have the ability to service our fleet. When that fish comes out of the water, that's where it has to start. Our marketing effort has to increase the amount of high-quality raw material so that we can support product development and our branded product. One of the other topics today that we'd like to discuss is really manufacturing efficiencies and what that means. We have a variety of customers now that they're pushing initiatives for us to be more efficient in our use of energy, more efficient in our use of packaging, more efficient in our use of transportation. I think everybody's heard about Walmart's initiatives and how they want to position themselves in the market. This, from a customer standpoint, this isn't really about they've become environmentalists. This is good business for them. This is how they want to market products in the future. And so I think that we're going to see what probably was called infrastructure a couple of years ago in the future is going to be called marketing, because the market is going to demand that we modernize facilities and we react to this. Tom Sunderland has spent quite a few trips back and forth to Bentonville. I'd like Tom to comment specifically on some of the scorecard process and where we think that industry and the state can cooperate to move this initiative forward.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. This is Tom Sunderland speaking. To talk to those issues, I want to say that as the guy in charge of marketing and product development and that sort of customer interaction, these activities are sort of they seem kind of undisciplined and they seem hard to grasp a handle on, but they really are. They really can be approached very scientifically in a lot of ways. And what Walmart's trying to do is they're trying to make a statement that they're all about efficiency. These things are all about efficiency, and so these will help Walmart succeed. But the way this works for us is our customers demand certain things of us, and they're going to score. They have scorecards, formal scorecards, that are published about how we will have to behave. Yesterday, these went into effect. So February 1st. So February 1st this year, everybody has 1 year to do it, and the first grade that comes out will be February 1st, 2008. As of that date, your score, according to all these measures, will be how you are rated, and the managers who buy the product within Walmart will have incentives to give people with good scores the buys. That's who they're going to sell a product to. There are a number of these things, for example, and they've been followed by, for example, Safeway. Safeway joined the Chicago Climate Exchange, and they've said they're going to reduce their greenhouse footprint by 25%, and it's just going on and on and on. This ball is really rolling. And just to give you an example of what, there are certain things in Walmart's scorecard. I said we've got a year until they give us a grade and say you're in or out. 15% of it is based on comparative greenhouse gas CO2 production. Now, that's something that we don't have a whole lot of control over as a you know, as a manufacturer. I have control over certain things, just saying reduce your packaging size and do all kinds of things and reduce how you shipping waste, that kind of thing. Those are our responsibilities. There's some of these, for example, reduction of greenhouse gases that, frankly, I look at it and I don't know how to succeed by ourselves. So I look at some of those issues. I look at, for example, renewable energy is 5% of the score. Greenhouse gas is 15%. There's a full 20% of the score, of which we're going to be compared not only to Alaskan seafood manufacturers, and not only to seafood manufacturers, but to food manufacturers. And so we have to compete against people in industries that are much more streamlined and have a much easier manufacturing environment than we do. And so when I look at this, I don't want to be placed in a position where I'm a disadvantage, where I say that just the nature of doing business here is extremely difficult, has a lot of very tough problems to solve. I want to be sure that I still get that sale, and I can stand up and say, we make the cleanest, most healthy product in the world. I need to be able to say to them that the way we do it also is in line with their needs for how we manufacture that. So those are the pressures that we're under. So, you know, we have pressures that come from regulatory issues that we deal with, and we have pressures that come from our customers that we have to deal with as well. And as we were discussing earlier, Mark and I, one of the issues with regulation, obviously, it's simply an issue, it's a law, and we deal with it. With our customers, we don't have to deal with it. We can go ahead and probably lose the business, but it's a matter of, you know, somebody will deal with it and lose and get the business. And so it becomes just as big an issue for us. And so we're facing a very, very big change in how the world views our manufacturing processes. We've never had companies come in and say, we need a carbon audit. We care about what you do, about these particular issues, but they are now. And those are issues that I think as individual industry members are going to have a very difficult time succeeding with without assistance.
This is Mark Palmer speaking. One of the things that we look at around the state is the amount of waste that the seafood system puts back in, and a lot of that waste is protein. It's things that could ultimately be recaptured in omega-3s and oils, biofuels, and where they're economically viable, they exist. You know, if you go to Kodiak, there's a fish meal plant that was privately funded. There's enough waste volume there that is an economically viable fish meal operation. It recaptures a lot of the waste and turns that back into marketable products and increases the value for those fishermen that fish out of that region. But just about anywhere else around the state where those plants don't exist, it's because they're not economically viable. In Cordova, there's really no pollock production there because they don't have the ability to deal with the waste. And those things that aren't economically viable, industry is not going to step forward and say, we're going to deal with this issue. They will wait for regulatory pressures to deal with those issues when we all have to stand up and address that. But as we get these pressures from the market, we'd like to be able to go forward and say, look at what we've done in Cordova. You know, we're recapturing this protein, we're reincorporating it, whether it's through fortified or pharmaceutical, nutraceutical products. Those are the kinds of things that our customers would like us to demonstrate that we're making efforts towards. That would be a partnership for state and private industry. We can manage, we can have an ongoing operation there, but it's genuine, basically the startup costs that are prohibitive for private industry. And so as we look around the state, parts of the state are aligned well to talk to this story. Where you're on a power grid that has hydro, there's a renewable story there. All of that we can weave into our marketing efforts, but we can go through and specifically identify different parts of the state that won't match up to this criteria. And what we would hate to see is sections of our state taken apart and have customers say, well, that's good Alaska fish and that's not good Alaska fish. We won't market that because it failed these carbon audits and these gas, you know, greenhouse gas issues and whatnot. So what we've looked at traditionally is marketing. You see brands, you see advertising, you see trade promotion, you see new product development. We think the state has done an outstanding job in supporting those efforts through ASME and through grant programs that we've taken advantage of. You've seen lots of new product development. We've put lots of products on the shelf, and we've put a fair amount of modernization into facilities to create those products. Our biggest concerns now are that we can get enough high-quality raw material to support the growth of those products. There really is a finite amount of top-quality fish that comes out of the state, and we need to expand that base. We need to concentrate those efforts on the underutilized species. And those are products that we develop and we can grow as long as there's a source for that. So again, starting with the vessels, we think that that's very important to put initiatives in front of them. But now the way we manufacture it, that part of the chain has been built. These are all new pressures for us to step up and address. And they're very much going to be identified as marketing issues in the years to come and not infrastructure, waste, and the kinds of things that we've called them in the past. Transportation, you know, we had some discussions last night with some of the representatives from our areas. But one thing with fuel and air transportation, Alaskan Airlines service to certain parts of the state have become more limited, and we certainly anticipate one example this year is going to be into Cordova. Everybody knows the success of the Copper River story, and the success is largely built around the value that that's created for the fishermen in that part of the state. The value of that fish exists in a fresh state. When we freeze that fish, that value drops by half. You do not recoup that value in the frozen market that you do in the fresh market. And when you can't access that fresh market because of limited transportation, you've certainly put at risk the value that we've created in that fishery. And, you know, we would like to coordinate more with transportation issues on the state and try and we've utilized the ferry system out of Whittier over to Anchorage to move a lot of the fresh fish from Cordova into Anchorage. Once it's there, we have pretty good lift out of Anchorage and a lot of options, but we have very few out of Cordova. And by getting the ferry into Cordova earlier and having it stay later, it's a huge opportunity to fill ground transportation where we lack air transportation now.
Earlier and later, are you talking about in the day, or are you talking about season?
Earlier in the season, earlier. Before May 15th, and I think probably after, well, if we went through the coho season about September 22nd, so it would be later before that's, I think that's moved to a different part of the state.
And just to follow up, you said before May 15th, or are you just talking about May 15th through September 22nd?
Those dates. May 15th is typically when we're going to see our first opener up there. So that would encompass what we feel is the body of the season where we can take advantage of that system.
Representative Ledoux.
With the limited air travel, do any of the boats deliver to Valdez rather than to Cordova? They're pretty close, aren't they?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, they are very close. There's certain processors that exist in those ports, and they serve as fleets that are based out of those ports. So Valdez certainly has access to the transportation, ground transportation through trucking down the Alcan Highway. But that doesn't service the fleet that's based out of Cordova and the processors out of Cordova. That's still where the largest percentage of the fish has landed.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Go ahead.
So, the products that we've focused on and that we've utilized most of our support from the state on has been focused on underutilized species. We've concentrated on pink salmon, chum salmon, and Bristol Bay sockeye. Those are the ones that represent 85% of the production last year in pounds. Those represent the lowest value in each of those species, and we feel that our efforts are to raise the bar there, and that's what's going to make a difference to the shoreside communities, to the fishermen, and really to the value of our fisheries to the state overall. And we feel like we've had great success. We appreciate the support the state's given us in the form of marketing grants. But we really think the encouragement for the state now has to be to address some of the basic infrastructure and manufacturing issues and production issues that we have, that that's what we will be marketing in the years to come.
This is Tom Sunderland speaking. In terms of marketing, when we go up on product development, we've got a few things to think about. First of all, we've got byproduct. So that lands in my head, and we figure out what to do with byproduct. Then we're left with a couple of issues. We've got product we already have, and we're like, how do we get the value up? And then we've got product that can come out in new forms and new things that we can do. Now, the first one, the byproduct, is just that's our issue. We deal with it. You know, we produce all kinds of things out of it. How we get the value up and how we do new forms, as we've succeeded in a lot of these products, like we're extraordinarily happy with the success of some of our cold smoked sockeye that we do out of Alaska, and a lot of those products have been tremendous successes. Our biggest issue now is getting enough high-quality raw material. So when Mark refers to infrastructure becoming marketing and then becoming kind of the same thing, to me, to market the product, to get the product to the value up, which is ultimately what my job is, we're running against a barrier of not enough fish of a high enough quality to, in fact, do that. And so it seems odd that people typically think of marketing as advertising and packaging and putting a new product on the shelf, but ultimately it comes back to a new product that fits the, you know, value maximizing algorithm out there in the market. I mean, you've got to figure out the way to make it worth the most you can, and we need to start with the raw material. And so our biggest challenge right now is how do we get more fish of higher quality? That would do more for us in marketing than anything else. And there's a thing about marketing, I believe, where someone once said that a good product or service makes a good brand. That's what it comes from. So it's our job to provide the good service, and we'll do as much as we can to handle the fish as well as we can to make the better quality raw material so we can come up with the best product. Where we feel we could use some assistance is in the other aspects of basic product quality, how the fish comes out of the water. That would do us more good in our ability to continue marketing and being innovative than any other thing we could do.
Just a moment. Just for the record, Representative Holmes has joined us. Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, both of you. Getting to that quality from when it first comes out of the water, it seems like traditionally the relationship between fishermen and processors over the last 100 years hasn't been the greatest in the world. So you feel like you're making progress with the fishermen. It seems to me kind of like a culture change. It's been so many years that, I may be wrong, but this is just what anecdotally I kind of have heard. The traditional battle between processors and fishermen must be difficult to integrate what you're trying to do all the way down to the deck of the boat. Do you feel like you're making progress over the last few years?
Through the chair to Representative Johansson, you're right about the history. I don't think that you're very accurate. It's interesting, as you know, the pressures from the fleet. A harvester would like to see prices go up every year, and when prices go up at the very start of the chain of your raw material, and that carries through and it compounds itself into recoveries, and that increase becomes something that we have to walk into a customer, we have to tell that customer, your prices went up because. They ask us, why does the price go up? What we would like to be able to have through the process from the customer back to the boat is to be able to say, if you want more money for your fish this year, what did you do to improve it? Why should you be paid more money? The consumer wants to know why they have to pay more for this product this year than last year. There's certainly the pressures of higher fuel costs, higher insurance. Those are the kinds of cost of living things that we're all faced with, and harvesters are faced with as well. But to make real incremental improvement in their economies, we have to do something different at the boat level. we've spent, over the last 4 years, a lot of time having those discussions with our fishermen. This last year, we went to every plant we have. We invited two fishermen, typically from different gear types, from each part of the state. We had 20-odd fishermen in Seattle early this year, well, I guess it was last year in 2006, just ahead of the season to explain to them. We took them through our value-added processing plants. We showed them what we do with their fish. We showed them what recoveries differences do to the retail price points at the grocery store. So the only way we're going to make headway is through education. And one of the ways that we've tried to do that is through financial transparency with some of our fleet, to just explain the economics, to show them when we cut fish of this quality, it yields us this much, and we have to sell it for that much, and the retailer's going to mark it up by X. But when we start with that exact same fish, and we can get a 10% better recovery out of it because it was less bruised, less gaping, what have you, we showed them the economics. And, you know, it's a process, but it's one that we're very much committed to and engaged in, and we believe it's starting to pay dividends. We've had more conversations with fishermen that are civil, marketing-type conversations in the last 3 years than we've ever had before. We're not always at odds with the fleet. And I think that a lot of them understand now that for them to move the bar, to compete successfully against aquacultured fish, that they're going to have to coordinate their efforts with processors. So I think there's been a tremendous progress made with the harvesters, and it's something that we're dedicated to and we're committed to.
Thank you.
And I just might say that, having been a fisherman in Cook Inlet for 19 years, that the idea of having some transparency in what's happening, financial transparency with the fish after they leave the boat, make all the difference in the world, because that was always the contention. Well, where were the eggs? Where were this? You know, it was always that the fishermen were getting ripped off and could never justify what the expenses were. So I congratulate you on that, because I know it could make a huge difference with the fishermen and their perception of working with you, instead of just talking about quality but never having that transparency of financial transactions, so they could see what the effects were. So
thank you, sir. Yeah. I think for our presentation, we've really covered what we think are the core issues around marketing and how it would not only support our company, but I think the industry at large, and the issues that we have to tackle, and hopefully issues that we can work jointly with the state in the future on to accomplish. Oh. If there's any questions.
You're great. Mark, and what I got down here was where there could be some working with the state was something aiding ice barges, such like the Bristol Bay Development Corporation. Now, was that for Bristol Bay? I mean, you don't need those in Prince William Sound.
It's different in different regions of the right. state. It's certainly dependent on the fishery, and you know whether it's a seine fishery that you have all RSW boats available to you or not. But I think that we need to look around the state and identify those places where an ice bled handling programs with the smaller vessels could be implemented, and we need to identify those and figure out how we could support them with more infrastructure for ice.
Well, it would really help us as we go through some of these things to get a little more detail on that. So if it turns out that you have a chance to write up where places where you think that particular items would be effective. I mean, we don't want to do a blanket program where it's not going to be effective in the places that's being conducted. And then you also commented on public-private efforts to allow the regions to work better on those scorecards. Is the scorecard available? Is that proprietary at all?
We've provided you a copy with it in okay. the materials here today.
Great. Appreciate that. And if you can give us any ideas on those particular items that were, you know, it's kind of amorphous when there's a scorecard out there, but if there's specific items where you can come in and let us know that this would help on a regional basis, not on a particular company basis, but on a more regional basis, the equity thing, that would help. And so, and then we have the question on the ferry Cordova to Whittier time frame. So those were the suggestions that I got from you. Did I miss any?
I think the low-interest loans for harvesters to modernize their boats, along the lines of the RSW incentive that was put forward, there's still a lot of opportunity there, Mr. Chairman. I guess we trying to look at private and public partnerships for community fish meal facilities to deal with waste and reincorporate those proteins and pharmaceutical and nutraceutical products back. And that kind of goes hand in hand with new product development, creating more value. And then again, I guess the rest of them we've captured, and we'll certainly provide more detail on the specifics of these energy audits and the scorecard process and regionally where we see that benefit.
That'd be very helpful, because then if we have a number of items from you, then we can share them with other, you know, with fishermen's groups and everything else, and see if we have some way we can come to some consensus on looking at some of those items and possibly going forward. So I really appreciate your presentation. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We learned yesterday that a chef out of Seattle is in the process of moving forward and opening up a restaurant in New York, and called Wild Alaska Salmon, if I'm not mistaken. But maybe if you could speak a moment or two to, you know, your from your perspective in terms of market penetration or opportunity, or maybe a relationship your company can have to an effort like that, you know, a restaurant, as I understand it, that would be the first of its type in you know, perhaps the major market in the United States. But maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Representative Edgman, through the chair. This is Tom Sunderland. Chef Charles Ramsayer was formerly a Ray's Boathouse for the past long time, 15, 20 years, has resigned from Ray's and is opening a restaurant in Manhattan that's going to be called Wild Salmon. And the concept is to take to New York, one of the premier food centers in the world, the concept of the regional cuisine from Alaska and the rest of the Pacific Northwest. From our perspective, I mean, we will be shipping them fish still, and we'll be moving that directly. So we have that component. But in a larger sense, I think this is one of those opportunities that doesn't come along very often to really build the Alaska brand and to really build the idea of what Alaska seafood is. This is one of the rarest opportunities I've ever come across. And I know that Charles has been in contact with ASME, and they're working on their side what they can do, because the New York press we're all aware of what power the New York press has, and you know that's what Charles has been talking about, that's really what this is about, is the New York press, and if he can create in that market the world's best seafood, then he will have changed the whole conception of Alaska seafood. And I actually think this is one of those marketing opportunities that you can't think of as strictly as how much fish we're going to sell that restaurant. I think this is a much larger opportunity. So from my perspective, I'm hoping and planning to hook onto this in any way that we can, because it's not called Wild Alaska Salmon, but it's called Wild Salmon. But at least it's called Wild Salmon, and they've put their stake in the ground around wild salmon and wild seafood from this part of the Pacific, and that has never been done in that part of the world. And the restaurateurs who are backing this are also restaurateurs in Europe and all over New York, so they have a tremendous amount of experience in that type of cuisine, in that type of media behind how you build this type of thing. So I'm hoping everyone else is excited as I am, is all I can say. Thank you.
We'll definitely look forward to it. Are there any other questions? Representative Ledoux and then Wilson.
Going back to this scorecard. So Does everybody have to make a certain score on the scorecard in order to be considered? How exactly does that work?
This is Tom Sunderland, Representative Ledoux through the chair. No, is the short answer. But all suppliers will be scored. And so, and it will be public within, well, within Walmart. So, for example, Ocean Beauty Seafoods, if we, whatever we sell them, they will go through and give us a score according to this. The competitors who sell whatever other products that that buyer is responsible for at Walmart, they will also have a score. Every single supplier will have to go through this, do all this work, fill this out, and a score will generate at the bottom, and that buyer, it will be visible to that buyer and also to that buyer's boss. So in other words, when the score comes out and we get a 50 and somebody else gets a 60, there's nothing in their rule says they can't choose the lower score. But they have said very publicly, the CEO, Lee Scott, and Rob Walton on the board have said very publicly that this is going to be the measure, the primary measure, along with price. They're assuming price is even, and this is Walmart after all. I mean, they always low prices, always is still there. They're going to use this as their tiebreaker.
Okay, because I was noticing that price didn't seem to be listed on this at all, and so that was what made me kind of curious about that.
Representative Ledoux, it was interesting. Last July, I had the privilege of being at the big Walmart kickoff meeting in Bentonville, Arkansas. They brought in Al Gore and all kinds. It was a very big deal. And they made it clear. I don't know if Walmart does this dance about always low prices and this. People who work there, but they made it clear this is about their way of how they can provide low prices in the future. Now, they see this as a business opportunity for them to become more efficient, and they see themselves as better at efficiency than anyone else. Therefore, they will be better at this than anyone else. So they've actually got 14 of these networks, for example. This is a scorecard from one of them. So it's an enormous program.
Yeah, follow up.
So when you say better at efficiency, is it their intent to get ahead of the regulator, what is probably going to come down eventually through regulations? Because I'm not seeing some of this stuff as really helping Walmart's efficiency.
Well, Representative Ledoux, interestingly, they do. And I think you are probably correct in your supposition that they see this as having a big public relations component, as having getting ahead of laws that are coming along, things like that. I've not heard that from any of them, but one can imagine that would be a good business case as well. All they have stated is that, for example, if they can reduce the amount of fuel used, if the amount of fuel used in that will reduce the cost to the consumer. If the amount of packaging they have to dispose of from all the cases and cartons and that come into there, if those are reduced, they will reduce their cost of getting rid of that stuff. If they can, some of them believe that there may be carbon taxes in the future. So this is they publish their carbon footprint and all this. It's now part of their annual report. So I think part of it is getting ahead of anticipated regulatory changes, and I think part of it's they look at their own, a lot of their success is based on having very efficient trucking, very efficient logistics, running very efficient stores, and they see if they can even reduce their fuel usage even further, for example, on their own trucks, that reduces prices, and if they can reduce the electrical usage in their freezers, that reduces prices for their consumers. So that's how they express it to us.
Are they going to publish it outside of Walmart? In other words, will your competitors be able to get a hold of your scores? Will the public have your scores? And will you have your competitors' scores, et cetera? Do you know?
This is Tom Sunderland, Representative Ledoux through the chair. I don't know the answer to that. It would surprise me if it were completely transparent all the way to all of that to the public. But I don't know the answer.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize. I had another committee, and I hate that I missed this. And so forgive me if you've explained this before, and it looks like to me as I went through this real quick that you have, but what percent of the market do you have here in Alaska and overall? Can you tell me that?
This is Mark Palmer, through the chair, Representative Wilson. Last year in salmon, Ocean Beauty processed 17% of all the salmon in the state.
Follow-up? Now, is that of all the different processors, is that the biggest percent of everyone, or because I don't know how many there are and how the pie gets divided and everything?
I believe so, that was the largest percentage of salmon by a single processor last year.
Thank you. And I know that you probably do more things with it than anybody else does too, although I don't know that for sure.
Over the years, you know, we are a shore-based salmon processing facility for the most part. That's what our core competency is and our single largest specie at every facility we operate. We employed almost 2,000 people in the state last year to run those salmon operations. And we have, I think, quite a regional economic benefit to those shoreside communities and rural communities that we're involved in. But we're very focused on salmon. I think unlike a lot of other companies who have whitefish resources, large crab resources, we really have one thing that we had to make successful. And I don't think that there was a tougher component of the seafood industry in Alaska over the last 8 or 9 years than the salmon business. And as we watched a lot of other salmon companies go out of business and we acquired some of those facilities, it's invention's the mother of necessity or mother of, so we had no choice but to make salmon successful, and that's kind of what we think about every day. And as an end result, that we have developed a tremendous amount of products for a lot of different market segments, from ready to eat, smoked, frozen, fresh, and we have quite a distribution network in the lower 48 to access the end user. So we kind of took that next step. Ocean Beauty's always had a distribution component to our company where we can get our products from the boats right to the end users. It's really been that balance of our position in the market and our product development and the variety of products that have kept us as survivors in the salmon industry.
Follow up?
So just one more. I'm envisioning wild salmon store or restaurants just popping up all over. That would be wonderful.
We would like that as well.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and sharing with us this morning not only the products that you're doing and how this scorecard works and some of the things for the future, but also the specific suggestions on how the state can work with the industry to promote it, and we'll look forward to your more detailed comments to us on those individual projects. And thank you again for coming.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Committee.
And now we have Fisherman's Fund. We have the Department of Labor.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, and would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and appreciate your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul F. Lasanke. I am the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. With me here today is Mr. Michael Mongle. He is also with the Division of Workers' Compensation, and he is the administrator of the Alaska Commercial Fishermen's Fund. We appreciate your invitation to come before you and help you in your oversight responsibilities by making a presentation about the Alaska Commercial Fishermen's Fund. We recognize that your time is very precious in committee, so we've tried to hone it down to an effective, hopefully, but also brief presentation. And if there are any questions that are prompted by our presentation that you don't feel you have time to ask us while we're before you, we'll be very glad to respond to them in writing at any time. The Alaska Commercial Fishermen's Fund was established in 1951, obviously before statehood. It is a dedicated fund. As you know, the Constitution doesn't like dedicated funds, but under Article 9, there were a number of pre-statehood dedicated funds that were grandfathered in, and that's what the Commercial Fishermen's Fund is. The funding stream that we operate out of comes from 39% of all the money that is paid to the state for commercial fishing licenses and limited entry permits, but the maximum cap is $50 per individual. In 2006, the revenue stream that was paid in was just under $982,000. Before I came over this morning, I took a quick look at some historical data that we have. And in the last 4 years, our revenue stream has centered up right around $1 million per year. It's in a very narrow range, about plus or minus $30,000. So sometimes a little bit more than $1 million, as you've seen last year, just a bit below. The reason that I am here talking to you, as we've noted, is that the Commercial Fishermen's Fund is administered within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. The Department of Revenue is the custodian of its funds. It is through very careful stewardship over many years, it has been able to develop a balance, which we carry forward each year. That balance is invested for the fund by the Treasury Division, and I'm sure you've heard of the, I believe it's JFANSI, but anyway, that's where the money goes. And although it's not directly relevant to the operation of the fund itself, the interest that is earned on that balance is of interest, I believe, to members of this committee, in that up to 50% of it by statute can be appropriated each year for statewide marine safety training and education programs. So they are not administered by the fund, but they're something I'm sure that falls under the purview of this committee. As a 55-year-old fund with a balance, I'm sure you're interested to know where it operates out of. I can assure you to its misfortune, it doesn't have a big palace somewhere. It operates out of about a 500-square-foot footprint within the Division of Workers' Compensation's offices at 1111 West 8th at the foot of the bridge to Juneau here in Juneau. It's a very spare and efficient set of cubicles and no frills. We are overseen, in addition to the legislature and this committee, by a Fisherman's Fund Advisory and Appeals Council. As I've noted in the materials we gave you, they are appointed by the governor to 5-year staggered terms. They're appointed, each one, from one of 5 districts that make up all the fishing areas in the state from south all the way up north. And each district has one individual who's appointed, as I said, for 5-year terms, and they are often reappointed. Day-to-day activities. We have 2 technicians who do all the hard in the trenches work of dealing with people who are asking for payments, making sure that the payments are made in a timely manner and made consistent with the legal requirements. And as I noted, Mr. Monagle here to my right is the administrator of the fund, but to conserve resources, he is not only engaged in administering this fund, he also has another fund in the Division of Workers' Compensation, the Second Injury Fund. So the Fisherman's Fund pays a prorated amount of his salary, reflecting the fact that he does not work for them full time, but he does an excellent job in running the fund. He's been there since 2005, and I can assure the committee that the fund is functioning better today than it was when he started. Very proud of his efforts. And obviously, when there are some other activities that require either director level or division level administration, as I've noted in our materials, that's when you get to see me and also pay a small prorated portion of my salary. The second area I'd like to touch on is just what are the benefits and what are the procedures for their payment. The benefits consist of health care costs that are reimbursed to providers for health care that they give to licensed commercial fishermen for injuries and certain occupational diseases which are listed by statute. That must be directly connected with commercial fishing activities, either ashore or in Alaskan waters. And I looked up before I came over, and Alaskan waters in terms of this statute is defined very broadly to take the whole 200-mile limit. It's not just the territorial waters. There are caps on what can be paid out initially under the statute. The initial cap on payment is $2,500. That money can be used for the actual health care or related transportation expenses, prescriptions, all the things that would flow from getting treatment. The initial duration of those benefits is 1 year. Now, it is possible, and part of the reason for having the Appeals and Advisory Council is for people to ask for the duration or the amount of benefits to be extended. And the statute says that they may be extended for quote-unquote compelling reasons, that Representative Ledoux, Representative Holmes, and non-lawyers as well will recognize that that's a fairly broad statement. And basically, we can get into it later if you'd like, but basically the council weighs all the individual circumstances of the injury and the treatment and what can be gained by the treatment and whether there are any other sources available before they make a decision to extend the benefits. As I noted, there are no payments for any costs that are covered by public or private insurance. The Fisherman's Fund is essentially a payer of last resort. It is designed to try and give people who are commercial fishing some limited amount of support when they don't have any other source of payment for their health care. The way that it is actually that a claim is started, we have a booklet here. We can give you copies if you'd like. It's a brief summary of the requirements and procedures, and it also has a claim form in it. And that would be submitted. We've also...
Representative Wilson.
Pardon me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question. I understand the injuries that can happen, but what are diseases that are covered that... I know in here it says arthritis, heart disease, diabetes, but you can't say that those are directly results from fishing, or can you?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, those are probably the hardest ones to address by the council because of that very point. But they give individuals an opportunity to... The way I would describe it is basically describe how those conditions have been perhaps accelerated or aggravated or made worse. But those there are gray areas, and that's why the council ends up scratching its head sometime trying to decide whether they truly fit within the statutory prescription.
So carpal tunnel or something like that would be obvious, but it's the other ones that would be...
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Some are much more obvious than others, and some are not at all obvious and end up being denied also.
Sure. Representative Ledoux.
Let me start out by saying that I think the Fisherman's Fund is a great program. But I have some philosophical problems with the crew members being charged even $50 a year out of the licenses for that program. And the reason for that is, under maritime law, which is something that I do when I'm not being a legislator, a vessel owner is absolutely responsible, absolutely, for any injury which is incurred or is manifested during the course of a crew member's employment on that vessel. So it seems to me that by charging crew members and taking that you're actually shifting the responsibility.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I mean, I certainly appreciate the observation that you're making based on your experience. And, you know, it was set up in 1951 the way it was, but I certainly understand what you're saying.
Well, that's been an obligation, though, that's gone back to Roman law. Though, I mean, it's been a long time. It's a concept. It's called maintenance and cure, and it's kind of a saltwater variety of workers' compensation, because I guess the reason why the Fisherman's Fund was set up in the first place is because the crew members don't come under the workers' compensation.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you're absolutely right that by specific statutory exemption, commercial fishermen fishers are not covered by the Workers' Compensation Act.
Excuse me, if I might, Mike Monagle speaking through the chair, Representative Ledoux. Most of the vessel owners carry insurance. They're not required by law to do so, however. So some roll the dice and operate without insurance. Most of the policies that you get for protection and indemnity have deductibles anywhere between $2,500 and $5,000.
Correct.
That's probably the normal deductible. I think the fund takes the crew member out of the position of having to try to collect from the skipper costs for their medical treatment when the skipper's paying out of pocket. And last year we looked at the number of claims that we have that are in excess of the $2,500. And most of the claims we have, I think around 90%, are less than $2,500 claims. So most of them are cuts and scrapes and strains, and the very few claims are the severe ones that are in excess of $2,500. And you're quite right that there are private means of coverage. Also have to keep in mind a lot of these are the skippers themselves. And when you go out and get a protection and indemnity policy, it does not cover the permit holder or the skipper. So a lot of times those are the folks we also treat. And they are not covered under a policy.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The as I was starting to say, the claim form itself, it seems that many people engaged in commercial fishing were early adopters of computers and the internet, and so we have put most of our materials on our website that we maintain, and we certainly encourage people, rather than waiting for the mail, to just download a copy of the claim, print it out, and send it in to us. And we're also starting to use the internet a bit for consultations with the Advisor and Appeals Council in to avoid having to get everybody together with the expense of transportation and the difficulty of finding a date when five fishermen can all be in the same place. And Mr. Monagle started that, and we're getting a lot of important large claims out of the way using electronic means, and getting a vote that way so that they don't have to wait until the next council meeting, because typically we only have two council meetings a year. And in the last few years, one has always been up in the rail belt somewhere, typically Anchorage, and then the others generally in Juneau. And just to the final point for that, if the claimant feels necessary, they make an appeal to the Advisory and Appeals Council. If they still are unhappy with the result, they can make an appeal to the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and that's the last administrative level appeal. And I suspect that they could through the courts if they wish to go further, but typically they do not. I think basically just because the amount of money involved is not large enough to justify that expense. If I could just take a few more moments of your time, I'd like to address, first I'd like to give you a snapshot of fiscal snapshot of the money coming in, the money coming out, and how we've been doing lately, trend-wise. And then I'd like to conclude by addressing a specific question that came up, I'm sure that the chair will recall, when in 2005 when legislation passed to adopt short-term crew member licenses, there was some concern about whether it might have any negative effects on the health of the Commercial Fishermen's Fund. So I'd like to conclude by a brief analysis of that. The revenue stream that the Commercial Fishermen's Fund has been seeing in the last few years is on a downward arc. I looked at the period from fiscal year 1987 to fiscal year 1996. During that 10-year period, the revenue was about $1.5 million a year. The more recent 10-year period, from 97 to 06, it's down to about $1.1 million a year. And basically, I think that's reflecting that there are fewer licenses being sold during that period. And as fishermen, I'm sure you're aware of all the challenges that have been facing that industry during the periods we're talking about. That probably explains in large part why the revenue streams are in the trend that we're seeing. For the last 10 years, The Commercial Fishermen's Fund has, on average, made payments on 795 claims, totaling about $591,000 a year in total payments. Over that 10-year period, after the cost of administration, it's left the fund with a surplus on average each year of about $280,000. This last year was the first year, and I think Mr. Monagle can correct me if my memory is off, but maybe as many as 15 years that the fund operated at a deficit. There was a fairly large spike up in the benefits paid out, and we also had a spike up in our administrative costs because we were trying to get some computer work finished that ended up being expensive. So we actually operated for the first time, as I said, about 15 years in a deficit mode of about $250,000. As I noted, we get very good oversight, not just from the legislature, but also from the Fishermen's Advisory Council. And so Mr. Monagle and I were grilled in a very kind way by the five members about why it was that we saw this situation and whether we thought we could get the administrative costs back down to where they were a year or two before. And we assured the council members that that was our intention, that we believe that the computer system expenses were a one-time event. But we're certainly keeping an eye on it. The benefits certainly can spike up. I mean, we're there to pay people when they need it, so we're not trying to force them down. But we certainly try and keep an eye on our administrative overhead, and I think by and large we do a pretty good job. The final point, short-term crew member licenses. We understand that in 2006 about 512 of them were sold. We set up, part of our change of the computer system was to set up so that we could monitor claims activity by that specific type of license. We did not see any claims filed against the Commercial Fishermen's Fund by the holders of those short-term licenses. I suspect that that won't always be true like that, but at least in 2006, there was absolutely no negative effect to the health of the Commercial Fishermen's Fund. All the money that was paid, the lesser amount of money that was paid for each one of those licenses, ended up funding benefits that were paid to holders of the perennial type of licenses. But we will continue to keep an eye on that, and if we see any kind of reversal of fortune there, we will keep in mind that the chair and this committee is concerned about that, and we will report back to you. Thank you for your attention.
And part of that concern was that with short-term licenses and being able to get more than one, you could get two, and instead of buying a full out-of-state resident commercial fishing license for $180, giving you the $50 fee, you buy a $20 license and you pay $11 into the Fisherman's Fund, but you have the same benefit coverage. And so we'll be interested to see if there is a trend downward in the number of full price non-resident, especially commercial fishing licenses, and being replaced by those shorter term ones by people just making the season, their full season, but a short season and leaving. So thank you very much. Appreciate that. Great update on that last bit too, and I'm glad your computer system will be able to track that for us in case we need to make changes. Does anyone else have a question from Fisherman's Fund? Thanks again for coming and
thank you very much
informing us how that works. We're now going to go to House Bill 26, which is the Geoduck Aquatic Farming Exemption. And since I'm the sponsor of the bill, I'm going to pass the fish to Representative Johansson and present the bill.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee. House Bill 26 is a simple bill. You know, it's one page here, basically, that just all it does is says that the an aquatic farm permit or a transfer permit cannot be denied just because gooey ducks aren't in the area where the farm permit is, or gooey ducks aren't wild in the area where that farm is and the transfer. excuse me. Just to give you a little disclosure on the origin of this bill, no one's approached me to ask me to sponsor this bill. I have never participated in the mariculture industry applying for a permit. I don't intend to apply for a mariculture permit. My background and no organization has asked for this bill. My background is that I have a Bachelor of Science from UAF in including wildlife management. I have a Master's of Science from San Diego State in marine zoology, and I was in a PhD program at University of California, Santa Barbara in marine ecology. And I've been a commercial fisherman for 30 years. But as a representative of the state, I know what's been happening in our fisheries and the volatileness of our industry. And so, you know, I am looking out for, are there opportunities for our coastal communities for alternative economies? Because as we saw with the crab rationalization program, over half of the crew members that used to, and skippers as well, used to fish the Bering Sea for crab are no longer in the fishery. We see a possibility of Gulf rationalization, that's the Gulf of Alaska rationalizing the other fisheries, and we should expect those same kind of results in those fisheries, which means that many of the fishermen in our coastal communities and the small coastal communities that depend upon those fisheries for their economic base aren't going to be working in those industries anymore. So when we look at these things, I look around and say, is there something else that can be provided for an economic base? We live in the far north here, and from my area on out west, you know, it's hard to talk about farming. Sometimes it's even hard for people to talk about gardening. But, you know, we have strong winds. We have cold winters. Anything that's above the tide line gets frozen. And so it's difficult to base an economy on that. Our wild capture industries go up and down, and so mariculture, shellfish farming seems to be a very logical choice if it can be done well. Gooey ducks are pretty unique animals. I might just preface that by saying that I fought really hard against the idea of salmon farming in Alaska. It has a lot of negatives to it. You have genetic inner problems. You have wild escapees that'll go into, could compete in the rearing grounds for in streams. You have farming where you're feeding the animals and the excess feed goes down to the bottom and pollutes the bottom. You have introduction of antibiotics into the feed. And for all of those reasons, you know, I did not think, as well as the rest of the legislature and people of Alaska, did not think that finfish mariculture in the wild waters of Alaska was a good idea. And so gooey duck clams are a very unique animal. They're sessile, meaning once they come out of the larval stage, they sit in one spot. In fact, they sit in one spot so much that we've been told by people if you take a mature gooey duck out of and lay it on the bottom, it'll just die because it doesn't even dig back in. So it's not like a razor clam that we've all dug where, you know, they dig down away from you. Part of the thing is that you don't have to worry about that competition because razor clams are in a very high energy beach situation where they can move. If you had in Alaska, in high energy beaches, gooey ducks wouldn't survive because they're not going to dig on down. Once they start digging there in one place, get up and move around at all. So also, there are no known infectious diseases in gooey ducks. Gooey ducks have been studied in Puget Sound quite a bit. There's farming in Washington. There's farming in Oregon. I mean, farming in B.C. extensively. They've looked at them. The only thing they've found is these little warts on them, and that turned out to be, with extensive biological testing, it was not anything that was infecting them. It was it's muscle cells that, you know, not quite like cancer, but muscle cells that they moved to the outside and form this wart around them. So it wasn't even something there. Yes?
I'm sorry, Representative Ledoux?
You used the term a high-energy beach. What's a high-energy beach?
A high-energy beach, Representative Ledoux through the chair, is a beach that gets wave action, fairly good amount of wave action, or where you have strong tidal currents. Anything that's going to move the sediment around, because gooey ducks do not dig out of the way in like a razor clam. If you have a high energy, you have waves come in and start eroding the sand, they dig on down and stay below the surface. Gooey ducks aren't mobile like that. Gooey ducks sit in one spot, and that's where they're going to be for their entire life. So they don't move at all.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Maybe you want us to ask questions as you go along, or?
Sure.
Okay. With the gooey ducks, you know, your bill is basically saying that you want to be able to have the permits in areas where there's no gooey ducks now. So I know in the past that they've looked in areas and the department has tried to say, okay, these areas would be good areas. So do you think that we could put seeds, you know, seed areas that had no gooey ducks ever before and that they would thrive? I mean, is that what you're thinking, Amon?
Sure. And here's what we've got. We've got gooey ducks that are, you know, taken from Southeastern. They're put in the water without heating of it up in Seward. That's where the single mariculture hatchery is. And they do just fine there. In fact, they raise the temperature up to make them spawn. We don't know whether gooey ducks would ever spawn in the wild up in, you know, in Kodiak, for instance. But we do know that they will grow. Remember, they're only filter feeders. It doesn't require any food. They're going to be filtering out of the water just like other things. The interesting thing is there's nothing that's identified that they're competitive with. In fact, the only thing that's been brought up so far to me about that they might displace was the number of polychaete worms. There's these little segmented worms, but in actuality, they found doing studies down in Puget Sound that after harvesting of gooey ducks, they were worried about it because you use a water jet to loosen the ground around when you pull the gooey ducks out, that they found that there was actually a slightly higher number of polychaete worms after they were raising gooey ducks and they were harvested. So there hasn't been anything identified that will be decreased. So like I say, gooey ducks are an interesting animal because they just sit there and filter feed. And up in the northern end of the range, such as with oysters, we do oysters in Kachemak Bay, and they never spawn because the water's too cold, which turns out to be a great deal because that means they never reach to where they're sexually mature, and that's when they get bitter, and so they can market them year-round. And so it's been a very great advantageous thing. But another thing about gooey ducks up here versus down in Puget Sound. In Puget Sound, they have them intertidal. Up here, we wouldn't need to have to worry about them being intertidal with our, you know, with our winters that we have here. It's all subtidal. It's down like down here where divers go down. Generally, you know, you're in 20, 30 feet of water, and it's in finer sediment that they're in. You go down from a boat with a jet hose, and you're putting water down into the substrate to loosen it all so you can pull the animals out. Let's see. There's, you know, been all a question with the salmon on genetic contamination. We don't have to worry about that. We're already taking the gooey ducks here from Southeastern up there. There are no gooey ducks up there, and so we don't have to worry about contamination between a wild stock and the other. One of the big problems is you've heard of the great gooey duck controversies there have been, and there's been bills. All of those things revolved around the problem of having a wild stock that you had commercial fishermen going out and getting, and ranchers or farmers who wanted to farm in that same area. Well, they wanted to farm in that same area for two reasons. One is if they got that area and there was a standing stock of gooey ducks, they would be able to harvest those and get the money from those to help support the farm. But that's a common property resource. So there was big dispute on there. And the other dispute is, if you're taking the area where gooey ducks are growing, that the commercial harvester could come back in a number of years and harvest wild stock from, all of a sudden that takes away that ground. Neither one of those is a problem if this takes place in Kodiak or Sandpoint or on the outer Kenai Peninsula. So those are a couple of the considerations. The other thing is that the state has established the mariculture hatchery in Seward, and that the Aleutic hatchery there is the only certified shellfish hatchery in the state of Alaska. Its business plan is based on providing stock. We were putting in initial money to get it going, and then it was supposed to be self-sustaining with the purchases from the industry. However, gooey ducks are valuable seed. You can import oysters, and oysters are cheap. And so it won't support the hatchery operation on its own. Its business plan relies on gooey ducks. There haven't been the gooey duck purchases. Finally, for the first time, there's cash on the barrel head for a gooey duck seed purchase from Southeastern. You know, it's been slow getting going. There was a few years ago, as I'm sure you remember, I think you were a co-sponsor of House Bill 208, which mandated that leases for farms go out. It's taken a while to get those permits and get everything up and running down here. And what we need to do for the hatchery is either decide we're going to subsidize it forever, provide a way so that there's a diversity of buyers so that we can get a sustainable source of income for that hatchery and it can be self-sustaining with the industry, or close it down and abandon the industry. And I don't think that that's a good thing. I think it's a great alternative possibility for our communities. It's not going to cost us anything to allow the private industry to go out and make the assessments on what areas they know will be able to support gooey ducks. You have to have upwellings. You have to have the right kinds of substrate. Private industry is going to have to go out and do that, nominate farm sites, put in their own money, their own analysis. Our problem is that we have a policy in the state of Alaska that says we will not allow anybody to farm gooey ducks outside of Southeast Alaska, because that's the only way they're found.
Before we go too far, Senator Wilson had a question. I don't want to get too far off sure. where we were before we get lost.
I have two questions, and one is before in Southeast Alaska, we kind of had to wait for the department to get around to going out and surveying areas and checking it out, and I think most of that was because there were wild gooey ducks in those areas, and so they came up with several sites and then opened them up for people to apply for that site. However, what happened is like one person applied for tons of those sites, and it wasn't even somebody from Alaska. And would you be, I'm sure there's nothing wrong with that, except that I would like to see that small businessmen, and it wasn't somebody that just was going to come in and massively do something. And so would you be amenable at all to limiting how many sites someone could buy at one time, or to lease, or I don't know they lease them? Yeah, they lease them. Where are you at on that?
Madam Chairman, or through the Chair, Representative Wilson, to me those are regulatory issues that I don't have a problem with, you know, if they want to limit something. I presume that what's going to happen is that the people in those communities, I mean, you have to be there to work these farms. And my presumption would be that local people would be applying for those. It would seem to me that we could have some, there could be some point system for, you know, for having a workforce, because one of the things that's required in the permit is you identify the workforce. So if somebody from New York is applying, just making an application to a farm, it may be difficult for them to identify a workforce in competition with the local, you know, folks in the local community that can say, John and Sue and Jim are going to be working this farm. But I don't have a problem with some mechanism to do that. I don't think it's necessary in this bill. This bill is real simple, and all it says is that for gooey ducks only, the department cannot use the absence of gooey ducks in an area as the sole determiner for not issuing a permit or not allowing transfer of seed from a certified hatchery. And the certified hatchery is the hatchery in Seward. And if that wording isn't tight enough, there is no intent to importing gooey duck seed from any other place. Since it's certified under this constraint, I think the only one that is state certified by our state is the one in Seward.
Wilson, and then Ledoux, and then Holmes.
This is a totally ridiculous question, probably, but I'm just curious. It says in here that the gooey ducks can get up to 14 pounds. How hooked in are they to? I mean, when they go down to harvest them, I mean, is it easy to pull them, or grab them, or whatever they do, or would somebody like me have a hard time doing it?
Representative Wilson, if you put on a dry suit and have a wand with a jet of water in it so that you put it down in the substrate, and then you're bubbling it all up. But if you went down and just tried to pull one up, you'd have a real hard time. You know, my understanding is that, you know, we have marine mammals that are going to use some of these as food. They do down in southeastern, they do throughout their range, but they're very extensive. And the interesting thing is they must lead a pretty good lifestyle, because they get up to 168 years old. So depending on the analysis, 140 to 168 years. So, oh.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
Are these gooey duck farms like set net sites in which the permit holder has to be on the site? Or could somebody have a site and be someplace else and just hire other people to run the site?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. Yeah, these farms are not like a commercial fishing permit where you personally have to be there to do it. You have to have control over the site, and you have to have, you know, people run the site. There's nothing that I know of anyway, but I'm not really the mariculturist. I guess maybe the department can tell us. But my understanding is that you've leased a farm site and you've got a permit. You have to work under the controls of those, but there's nothing that says that if you, Representative Ledoux, had the permit that your boy couldn't be out there doing everything and you in town. So,
But could I just be living in New York City and have the permit and have somebody run the farm?
I presume that you could. We'll ask Fish and Game when they come up, but the you know, it's just like a farm in Delta. If you have the farm in Delta, who's the owner of the farm and who's running the farm? I mean, it's not, you know, it's a leased piece of land. For this species, you have to operate within the permit, but there's nothing that I know of that you have to have a commercial fishing license that requires you to be there.
Thank you.
As the operator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You were just starting, you got cut off, Representative Seaton, as you were just going down another line. But I thought I heard you say that under current law, there are either statutes or procedures or something that dictate that gooey ducks cannot be farmed in areas where they aren't currently found in the wild. Is that what you were saying?
Well, It's an interesting thing, and I guess the department can outline their position. There are larval drift zones. That's some of the information that you have, and there's their policies are in there. However, actually, the statute, one of the statute that is HB 208 from the 22nd legislature, actually prime sponsor was my predecessor, says in a quote, aquatic farming sites for on-bottom culture of shellfish must be located in areas where either one, an indigenous population of shellfish species to be cultivated is not present. So depending on how you want to read that, you could read it that the first one says that you can't have them there. And then the second part goes on for, like, if there are the indigenous ones there, how do you have to get to an insubstantial amount of the population before that, you know, how do you handle that wild stock? But as you read the statute here, it says, you know, they can't be there. The regulations that they've adopted are a policy call saying we don't want to have gooey ducks, or we don't want to have any shellfish where they're not naturally present within this larval drift zone. But that's just a policy call, and that's our job as policymakers.
Follow up quickly before we're running up against some scheduling with another committee coming in here. So after Representative Holmes, I think we're going to hold on to this and conclude the meeting.
Thank you, Ms.
I was simply going to ask if we have those policies and procedures in our packet, and if not, if it would be possible to get them.
Yes, you do.
We do have.
You have those those policies in your. As you read those, so I hope you read them carefully, because there's a policy, but the every place where it says the policy is there, it says to prevent genetic contamination or prevent interaction with wild stock. So the rationale for the policy decision they've made is doesn't follow with the policy that they've found. In fact, in several places, it's contrary to the policy that they've adopted. The rationale aren't upheld at all. So we can go over those when Fish and Game.
Okay, and I see we also have two people on online, one on Homer and one off net. So we apologize to those folks, but we're being kicked out of the room for another meeting. And the true chairman will reschedule this at another time. So with that, we'll adjourn for the day.
And we'll have it on our next meeting.
Okay.